from your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Sunday night, June 1st, 2025, as we record this new episode. The Chicago White Sox wrapped up their road trip visiting New York and Baltimore. While we were filled with a little more optimism after a tough series for the White Sox against the New York Mets, they played the Mets real tough. Man, did that balloon pop in a big way after this weekend as the White Sox were swept by the Baltimore Orioles. And despite facing one of the worst pitching staffs in baseball, the White Sox scored a grand total of 5 runs. The White Sox are now 18-41, which puts them at a pace for 49 wins in 2025. That would hit the under preseason win total. They're also on pace to only score 552 runs this season. As we enter June, it's time to check in if the White Sox are making enough progress with this rebuild. Adrian Hauser pitched well again on Sunday, but Mike Tauchman is on a heater. Does he join Hauser as trade bait? Speaking of heaters, the red-hot Detroit Tigers, with Major League's best record, are visiting the White Sox this week, and then followed by the Kansas City Royals over the weekend. The White Sox are currently 0-for against both teams. Can they win a game this week at home against either Detroit and Kansas City? Finally, we take a look around Major League Baseball. Why division leaders on June 1st should be happy. The Rockies continue to sink to lower depths, and Shohei Ohtani, Aaron Judge, and Cal Raleigh, have they hit more home runs the first 2 months than any White Sox hitter will in all of 2025? Lots to discuss, so let's get started. Joining me is Sox Machine's managing editor, Jim Margulis. And hello, Jim. What a series in Baltimore. I was optimistic the White Sox would score some runs. In our previous episode, I was hoping, wishing, forecasting 15 runs scored, and they scored 5. What the heck happened in Baltimore, Jim?
Well, both teams combined to score 14.
Yeah,
so not even
close.
Yet in the Orioles' contributions, they didn't reach 15. Professional effort by the pitching staff. You know, they have that going for them. But yeah, just not a whole lot of offense. The biggest show of force was the Kobe Mayo base running adventure. The AJ Pierzynski home version, not as successful in drawing the interference call. I don't know if you saw that live in terms of with the Schifrin call, but
I missed the Schifrin call. I did see the play live, and I thought that Mayo was going to get the fielder's interference call until replay, and the Baltimore broadcast had a better replay than the White Sox did, where it was very clear that Mayo was trying to initiate that contact.
Yeah, I watched the Baltimore broadcast because I like their production. I find that they use a lot of useful camera angles to kind of highlight different things players are doing. And so usually I'll watch that broadcast 2 out of 3. I did kind of go back and forth because Dan Plesac was on the call, and I'm just kind of interested to hear how Schifrin works as somebody who isn't Steve Stone. But I had it on that one first, and then when the benches cleared, I went to the White Sox call rewound because okay, got to hear Schifrin here, because this is, he's been toned down this year to where we're not having Schifrin minutes very often this year. He's not standing out one way or another. I think that's mostly a good thing. But in this case, bench is cleared. One of the ways he made his mark last year, for worse, was the Tommy Pham incident, where don't care how many L's were taken.
We're not taking that.
Yeah, where he started throwing himself into the fight himself, even though Pham was the one in the wrong. So anyway, I wanted to hear this one, and I was pleasantly surprised that it's a case where he toned it down. It kind of fits the rest of the theme of the season for Schifrin, in that he did get excited, agitated. He did defend the White Sox, or stepped in to be somebody on the mic for them. But I think resisted going full slam ball mode, or full UFC. I guess it'd be UFC mode for just when you have people on the verge of having a fight. He said when Kobe Mayo was leaving the pile and just kind of glancing over his shoulder and being like the one by himself, he said, "Look at that Mayo, the first one to leave the pile. Isn't it funny how that starts? The guy who starts things off is the first one to leave the field. Make an exit, Mr. Mayo, make an exit." And it's like slightly cheesy, but then that was it. Like I was expecting the cart to go off the rails and be like, oh no, here comes the series of tweets, blue sky posts, awful announcing posts, Facebook posts, just piling on the Schifrin soundbite. And he avoided, like he said his piece, he showed his personality or what his instincts are, but he did not follow it to the same disastrous ends that the Tommy Pham play generated a year ago. So another sign of maturation, I think, on the side of Schifrin there by just saying his piece, then leaving it there.
Progress.
Very funny play though. Like that was, especially once they showed the angle from behind first base.
Yeah.
That was the play that AJ Pierzynski made famous with the White Sox for just getting in a rundown, sticking his elbow out and then, backpedaling and arms flailing like but it was very much the arm did the work and his body stayed within the baseline. And it was very comical the way that the glancing blow off the elbow caused him to start pinwheeling and spiraling out of control in the base path. But it drew the call, whereas Mayo threw his entire body onto the infield grass and like, no. and I liked the response of Sosa and Rojas just like looking at him on the ground, almost like pity, like, what was that? What do you do? We're the White Sox, and we think that's sad. We're literally the White Sox, and that's beneath us. And so I thought that was an appropriate response in the field.
Yeah, right call on the field. And speaking of progress, so here we are. We're in the month of June. The White Sox went 11-17 in the month of May. That's more wins in a single month than the White Sox had at all in 2024. So you can consider that progress, but the White Sox start June 0-1. And as we enter June, the White Sox are on pace to only score 552 runs this season, which would win me a steak dinner bet, and finish with a 49-113 record. The White Sox, if you look at their expected win-loss record on MLB.com/standings, are technically underachieving by 5 games. They should have 23 wins. That's their expected win total. What's not helping the White Sox is that they are 3-15 in one-run games this season. So that's going to leave a mark on the expected win-loss compared to the actual win-loss record for the White Sox. But the question I have for you, Jim, as we enter June, is enough progress being made by the White Sox this season?
On the pitching front, I think enough is happening. Especially starter wise to where like Davis Martin looks good. Sean Burke looks fine. Jonathan Cannon, assuming he's all the way back from like the back injury and the scratch, he looked a little rusty coming out of the gate, but stabilized, assuming that he's past whatever caused him to miss a start by a couple days. They're fine. Shane Smith, I think you're seeing a little bit of mid-season, not so much regression, but maybe league figuring out a little bit, him getting a little bit fatigued or just, not being as sharp. And so it's the June blahs now that he's reaching to where he's got to just overcome it. But like the stuff looks good. The stuff looks like it'll play. It's just a matter of like building up his conditioning. And then you have Adrian Hauser rounding it out. And like, that's a good mix of drafted players, a scrap heap pickup. And I think Rule 5 is probably, it's a different kind of scrap heap nonetheless. And then, veteran low-cost signing. Even before, like, Hauser, you had Martin Perez, who was filling that same role in terms of being decent for what you signed him for, which is being a veteran's innings eater. So, I think pitching-wise, it's fine. The bullpen has been better. I think there's, you see Will Venable finding some relievers he's trusting more than others. And, just a matter of like finding the right guy at the right moment. Cause I think like their low leverage guys are performing well in low leverage. It's just a matter of like when the save situations arise and, they start gripping the ball a bit tighter. Do they have the guys who can get those outs. But I think they're keeping the game within reach, which, you know, considering they're trailing for a lot of these games, like they trailed for most of the Baltimore series, just, you know, the bullpen kept the team within reach. So I think you're seeing evidence that the starters are there. Position player wise is the big question so far. I think right now it's a transitional period with the lineup to where a lot of the problems with the offense are because Andrew Vaughn's so rough. He's in Charlotte. Luis Robert Jr. looks like he should be in Charlotte. And without those two guys producing at even like average levels, which I, you know, nobody had grand hopes for Andrew Vaughn. I think, you know, hopes were higher for Robert, but just without them even performing in average levels, you just don't have a heart of the order. You have some guys who can get on base at the table, but they're setting the table for who? And that's not really happening. You have Joshua Palacio still getting a lot of at bats. He's cooled off a little bit. I mean, like, he looks like Joshua Palacios, which is a, you know, a quadruple A outfielder. And you know, that's no knock on him. It's just a case of they've had to go to that well a lot. They don't have the outfielders ready to replace a Palacios. Edgar Caro is getting adjusted to. And so you're seeing some growing pains there. So he's not like a savior that you want for the lineup. I'm kind of curious if there's gonna be like a Caro Teal swap coming up soon to where like they let's have Caro go back work on some things. Now it's Teal's turn to audition and figure out if he can stick or if there's stuff he needs to work on. And maybe, you know, while they're struggling and thriving at AAA, that's when you swap them back and forth. But that's, I think the lineup is still just a big question mark, and I think will be for quite some time because it's relying a lot on Mike Tauchman, which is fine in a way because they, you know, it's a case where you want him to work because the White Sox have to get good at acquiring average position players from wherever. So like no knock on him. It's ultimately a plus. Same thing with Austin Slater being the short side of a platoon. Like it's very modest hopes you have for him, but at the same time, like the White Sox have struggled to find those guys who can even do one thing well. So, you know, kudos to the right field plan. It's just without Robert there, without Benintendi being what he was in the second half last year, you know, what's the 3-4-5? They really don't have that right now. And until they do, it's hard to like figure out, you know, where this team's going to score runs aside from just having those games like the Mets game, the finale where just like everything goes right. They get four hits with runners in scoring position to score five plus runs. And it coincides on a day where they're pitching well enough to win.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're still like we're still buying on Miguel Vargas. Like, hopefully Vargas could be one of those guys that helps out in the middle of the order. But I'm with you, Jim. Even if you go down to the minor league,
yeah, I should say 4-5-6, not 3-4-5, because Vargas has been pretty solid in the third spot.
This is where for me, like Colson Montgomery, who got hit in the knee, I'm not sure if he's officially been placed on the injured list, but him underachieving and that whole weird situation.
Yeah, X-rays were negative for Montgomery, so they're hoping a couple days rest would fix it.
Got it. But like when you're trying to build out like a future roster for this White Sox team, it still feels like a year or two away from getting solid answers at all positions. Like Chase Meidroth right now is doing the best that he can at shortstop. He's holding it down there. Maybe Miguel Vargas is the White Sox first baseman of the future. They stuck him at first base all series against Baltimore. You got to feel confident about Kyle Teal and Edgar Caro behind the plate for the White Sox. But are they sold? Are the White Sox sold on Lenin Sosa? Is he going to stick around? I mean, he's out of options. You got a hole at third base because Brian Ramos, this is like almost a, just like Colson Montgomery, a complete off year because of injuries. And we're not getting answers if Ramos can be someone that's got a long future in the major leagues. And the near future for the outfield is like Brady Montgomery and who else? Like the outfield really needs to be addressed by the White Sox, especially after this season and what the future is. So I'm with you that there's enough progress being made on the starting pitching front. I think you have some answers in the infield. But moving forward, especially in the second half of this season, that White Sox front office, they need to start trying to figure out answers, especially in the outfield and other key areas as far as within the position player group, because that's where the biggest questions are at the moment. Now, you mentioned Mike Tauchman. Tauchman is on a heater for the White Sox. It's just 12 games, but his OPS is over 1,100. It's 1.132 to be exact. Against Baltimore, Tauchman was pretty much the White Sox offense. He was 6-for-12 with a home run, a triple. He knocked in two runs out of the five the White Sox scored, and he also walked. And he looks good, Jim. He looks good at the plate, even though he suffered a couple of hamstring injuries. It does have me wondering, I mean, at this stage of the season, the best compliment I can get to give to any White Sox veteran is you're playing so well that you're going to play for a new team come August. Is Mike Tauchman on that list? Is he now trade bait?
I think so. I think with the power he's showing that he didn't show last year because of just how opposite field oriented his swing was, that the ability to pull the ball is back and gets on base should find a home. I think there's maybe a limited amount of demand just because the White Sox were able to sign him for a relative pittance to where, yeah, probably the market remains the same on him in terms of, well, you need a platoon partner for him. He's not going to hit with the typical thump of a right fielder. He's not a plus defensive outfielder, but he's fine out there. So, you know, he's got some weaknesses to where he's not going to, I think, transform a lineup, but, you know, we saw Paul DeJong get traded last year, and, you know, with the power he showed, and, you know, it was a case where he didn't one thing well enough, which is hit homers and be able to stand at shortstop, even though, like, the metrics didn't like his shortstop play at all, to where the Royals traded for him. So with that in mind, if Tauchman is getting on base and only doing that, like, if the power regresses a little bit and he's back to slugging 400-ish or closer to 400 than 500, and it's not defining him, then probably getting on base, strong walks, long counts, your professional at bats is going to be his calling card, and the team will sign up for that. However, if this power hangs around to where, you know, he's able to pull the ball in the air, it's different. Like, it's a case where teams can always want somebody who pulls the ball in the air. Like, it's hard to make a living hitting the ball opposite field out of the park. Like, Tauchman did that last year in Wrigley because of the way the winds were working and just how much it punished balls in the air to right field, that he was just trying to make it work in his home park. And, you know, that's probably one of the reasons why the team saw the way he was hitting and being like, oh, is his bat slowing down? Is he just conceding to age? And now he's just trying to poke the ball to the left field, kind of like the Andrew Benintendi Kauffman Stadium approach, where he sacrificed power, only hitting five homers and just figuring, like, I'm just gonna take advantage of those deep alleys. Except Benintendi signed for $75 million. But Tauchman, I think, is a case where if he's pulling the ball in the air, along with, like, getting on base above average rate, like, yeah, he should have a pretty wide market. Maybe not like a market of everybody's gonna be champing at the bit to trade a top 100 prospect for him, but at least maybe enough to drive up the price a little bit and be a little bit more than, say, like a Gerald Rosado, which is what the White Sox got from the Royals for Paul DeJong.
I totally forgot what the White Sox got for Paul DeJong, but to your point, they were able to find someone to take on Paul DeJong, as DeJong was a bench bat, and I assume that's what Tauchman will be for a contending team. I just don't think he's going to be around for a long time. So enjoy this heater while you can, White Sox fans. Now, someone that White Sox fans do not want to be around for a long time, I don't even know if White Sox fans want him around in a short time, and that is Luis Robert Jr. He's been a very popular topic in our podcast episodes this year, because he's one of the critical players for the White Sox. They were hoping that he performed well enough that they could trade him before the deadline, get more impact prospects, because he does have a couple of club options that could help enhance this rebuild, maybe answer some of those questions in the position player front that Jim and I still have just a couple segments ago in this podcast episode. Against Baltimore, Robert went 0-for. He was 0-for-10 against the Orioles. He got on base with two walks, and he reached on an error. He struck out 7 times. So out of the 10 plate appearances that resulted in an out for Robert, he struck out 7 times. Now, Robert has 5 years of service time. So, Jim, what I am seeing on social media is a lot of White Sox fans saying, well, Andrew Vaughn had options. Just do what you did with Vaughn and option Robert to Charlotte. Because of that years of service time, the White Sox can't do that without Robert's consent. And I'm sure if the White Sox approached Robert to option him in Charlotte, he would probably be advised by his agent to not consent to that and instead of just be put on waivers, which then that starts the trade conversation pretty much immediately with a very short window to negotiate a deal if Robert does get claimed by another team. And I'm assuming with his speed and defense that he would get claimed by another team, and that would be a very weird way to end the Luis Robert Jr. tenure with the Chicago White Sox. But Jim, is that a possibility we now have to seriously consider for Luis Robert Jr. if this does not get better in the month of June? Because we're running out of time here to see a better version of Luis Robert Jr. to convince another team to give anyone up in significance of prospect level in negotiations with Chris Getz.
Yeah, the 5 years of service time is tough. He has to consent to it. And I think given the state of where he's at, he hasn't been like wanting to get traded in terms of like the way Lance Lynn wanted to get traded or the way Kendall Graveman wanted to get traded. Just putting feelers out there, to reporters. I think he's just more, aware of what this means for him. And so he's just operating on the assumption that he will not be hanging around the White Sox. But yeah, if he's goes down to the minors for more than 2 weeks, like the White Sox can get back a year of service time. That kind of complicates maybe an exit, even though he has a guaranteed contract or like he's coming up on it, still gets a little bit hairy, I think, in terms of what the White Sox would have to pay him if he's like final year of arbitration eligible, like, you know, without, yeah, you know, it gets in a weird territory with the options and what he's been making to where like there isn't really a, like with Andrew Vaughn, there isn't a benefit for an extra year of service time because like he's just going to be making the same amount of money thereabouts. Like his pay can be reduced a little bit if he goes in arbitration, but not enough to change the calculus in which the White Sox do not want to pay him. So there's the, I think maybe what might be most likely in terms of maybe even the same benefit without, you know, worrying about any kind of service time thing or accepting a demotion and the team promised to bring him up as soon as possible. But I wonder if there's like a phantom IL stint involved to where they say, oh, he has a hip problem or something that you couldn't, you know, necessarily detect. He goes on the IL for 10 days, goes with the rehab stint, you know, maybe does some offsite work, maybe goes, you know, Ryan Fuller, what's up? And then, you know, they work a bit, goes to Charlotte, gets a tune up. And, you know, perhaps that's his option period without actually being an option. That's something I could maybe see happening given the delicate nature of the circumstances, given that he can't miss too much time and can't, like, because he has an injury history, they can't really say he's hurt again because that creates a whole different complication with the Luis Robert Jr. story of, oh, he can't stay in the field. So it would have to be pretty abundantly clear, like he is not really hurt. And it's a way to get him back on track. But something like that, like a reset of some kind, that seems to me to be maybe the simplest option if they can figure out a way to do it, if Robert's amenable to it. Because I imagine Robert's, you know, we've seen his quotes that he's not trying to false bravado his way through it by saying, I'm better than this. Turnaround's right around the corner. Just watch me. He's being very direct in the sense that like, I'm not performing. It's been a struggle. It's not great right now. So he might be amenable to something that maybe doesn't cause him to not reach free agency and the options and everything like that to give him the best chance of, because I think Robert, even if like, you know, he doesn't get traded, he follows like the Eloy Jimenez path of getting traded to a team that can use his outfield play. And if that doesn't work out, they won't pick up his options and he's a free agent. And then he has to find the best possible deal. Like even that gives him a chance to talk to other clubs, figure out who might be the best team to get him back on track and be the player he wants to be. So there's a benefit for him reaching the open market, even if he's not making the money that he planned to make under those option years. So that's why I don't see him doing anything that delays that or complicates that. But there is that IL stint might be the way to do it in a way that acknowledges the struggles right now. Because right now the White Sox basically have two Michael A. Taylors, and that's too many, I think, in my opinion, because it's the Taylor signing itself seemed like a hedge against a spring training trade of Robert, and having them both on the roster at the same time performing like the lesser version of those two players is it's really dragging things down.
The Phantom IL stint, very popular in social media. Many are making the same suggestion, Jim. You just need something, some type of ailment that you can use in order to generate that IL stint. And I don't even know if there is one right now for Luis
Robert. The hip's always a popular one, I think, in terms of like, you can't really see it. Just like, oh, I felt something.
Yeah, I guess.
It'll be better.
I think where my head is at, like one question, and I never have clarity on this. For someone that has a club option, if you DFA them, you put them on waivers, and after the waiver period, you just release them. How does that work with that club option? Do you just owe them the buyout then?
I think you owe them what's guaranteed, the remainder of the contract in the buyout.
In the buyout. So the $2 million.
Minus the league minimum that the team that picks him up eventually and pay, you know, employs him would pay him. So
got
like
it.
The 700,000 or whatever it is now, that's covered by another team or the prorated version of that. But everything else that is owed to him is owed by the White Sox.
Got it. So that's your whole sunk cost fallacy argument. Like you have to pay him no matter what the rest of this year, you have to pay him the $2 million in the buyout. What is that break even point? When do you make that decision as the White Sox? I think it's August 1st. Like, if you can't find a suitor for Luis Robert and he continues to perform this poorly through June and July, we are talking about if Robert can't get on a heater and has an OPS below 700, after August 1st, you're in discovery mode, aren't you, Jim, for the White Sox? Like, you need to start figuring out answers going into 2026. Like, if he can't bring anything back, that's when I would put Robert on waivers and see outside of the trade deadline, you can work out a deal through the waiver wire post trade deadline. But that's where my head is at right now in handling the Robert situation. Like, continue to go through this, hope something changes. But after the trade deadline, if it's still this type of Robert, if he's got an OPS below 600, it's probably just best to let him go, walk away, and start figuring out what outfielders you want to see for the rest of this season and into spring training and start trying to come up with a plan, because you know Robert is not going to be part of that plan.
Yeah, I mean, waiver trades don't exist in the way they used to.
Right. That waiver deadline into August. Yeah.
Yeah, revocable waivers, that thing doesn't exist anymore. So it'd just be a matter of like if a team claims him. The problem is with that is like if they trade Talkman and Slater, there'll be plenty of at-bats for discovery in the corners. Like you can't turn over all three outfield positions and be like, how many more Joshua Palacioses are out there to
Corey Jokes, baby. He's hitting.
Yeah. I mean, but that's the dead end you get into where it just, you're going to all these Zach Deloaches of last year that end up getting DFA'd and not claimed by another team, so they're still in the organization. That's what you get into when you just try to audition for the sake of audition. I get what you're saying. And like, yeah, in a vacuum, there's no point in playing them. And we saw that last year with Moncada, that they just said like, well, we'll call you up, but we're not going to play you. We're just going to turn the page on you. And there might be some like emotional value or just acknowledgement that the page is being turned, kind of like everybody felt, I don't know, better is the case, but just felt like a sense of closure when Jimenez and Moncada were out, because like there's just the false hope that every single off-season plan or spring training plan A was built around. Like, you no longer have to worry about that or just have that in the back of your mind. You can just concede it being like never going to happen. And so like you can keep doing that, but as we're seeing right now with the White Sox team, it's still on track to win fewer than 50 games. Like that has limited value in terms of actually improving the talent on the field. So like his defense is still valuable. When he gets on bases, his base running still valuable. So look, I like the idea of, I've seen him bat seventh, like bat lower, subbing him out.
Lower? Yeah. I mean, you start like, by, yeah, I mean, bat him ninth.
Yeah. I mean, like it's a case where if he's playing that poorly, just like he's Michael A. Taylor. That's kind of how you have to think about it. Like, he's there for his glove, and if he gets on base, it's gravy. But yeah, it's unfortunate, but and it's both unfortunate but also amazing that like all these contracts that Rick Hahn signed, you know, Moncada, Jimenez, Tim Anderson, well, it's funny, like even Adam Eaton wouldn't have gotten to the club option stage, like because of his knee injuries, like his game collapsed before he became a free agent because they declined options on him. Just like every team option period, like in the whole idea of like service time being valuable, like all these extensions are a great argument against the whole idea of jealously guarding service time, because everything is collapsed by even before the point that they got to those team options.
None of them, right? Not a single one would have played a year under their club option.
Jose Quintana, I think.
Okay, well, yeah, that was pre-rebuild.
Well, Adam Eaton was in that same boat.
He was. Yeah, that 5-year, $24 million contract.
Yeah, which that was a no-brainer. And like Tim Anderson's was a no-brainer. Then they just got exponentially more expensive as players realized, like, hey, we're selling our services way too cheap, and we have to make teams take a little bit of a gamble on our services. And the White Sox have lost that gamble.
I don't have a real good idea. Like, my idea is not even all that good. It's hard to come up with any idea to get him back on track. Like, maybe the Phantom IL stint can work, sending him to Arizona. It's bad. That's all I can really say.
Yeah, it's unpleasant.
Yeah, we're all grasping for straws right now, and for the White Sox to figure out Luis Robert and Luis Robert to figure out himself. He's put himself into a tough situation as far as his major league career. Moncada seems to be doing okay with the Angels, but he only signed a $5 million deal. When you buy a gigantic house like Luis Robert did after signing the contract, you're thinking, hey, I have the confidence in myself. I'm still going to be playing well. I'm going to get those $20 million in 2026 and 2027. So hoping to get $40 million, but you're going to only end up getting two. That's quite the pay cut. Well, from
what I learned from Adam Eaton and Todd Frazier is that he shouldn't have a mortgage.
He shouldn't, but he did not buy a $1 million home, Jim.
He
bought a $14 million home.
I've learned that mortgages for major league players are unseemly.
Unseemly. Very true. Very true. So that's the Luis Robert situation. As Jim mentioned, cap tip to the White Sox pitching. They did well against Baltimore, just holding the Orioles to 9 runs. Now the Chicago White Sox head home. They have a homestand, 7 games against AL Central opponents. The first 4 are against the Detroit Tigers, who have the best record in Major League Baseball. At game 60, they are 39-21. They won their last game. In their last 10, they are 6-4. However, they have won 6 of their last 7 games. On the road this year, the Tigers have performed well. They are 18-13 away from Detroit. Offensively, the Tigers' offense is averaging 4.93 runs per game. They have a top 10 team OPS, 725 overall. That's good for 9th in Major League Baseball. On the road, very similar, 726. That's good for 6th in Major League Baseball. They hit the majority of their home runs away from Comerica. That's not a shock. They have hit 68 home runs as a team. 40 of those have been on the road. On the pitching side, very consistent. The starter ERA is 3.15. That's good for 4th in Major League Baseball. The bullpen ERA is 3.24. That's good for 3rd in Major League Baseball. So another series for the White Sox, just like against the Mets, facing a top 5 pitching staff. On the road this year, away from Comerica, the Tigers have a 3.71 staff ERA. That's good for 8th in Major League Baseball pitching on the road. So still a good mark for Detroit. Your pitching problems for this series, Monday night at 6:40 p.m. Central Time, first pitch temperature could be 80 degrees. Finally warm in Chicago. Jack Flaherty will get the ball for the Detroit Tigers against Jonathan Cannon. Tuesday night at 6:40 p.m. Central Time, it could be 85 degrees at first pitch. But keep in mind, there's a high chance of rain on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. To be determined for Detroit against Shane Smith for the White Sox. And on Wednesday night, to be determined again for Detroit against Sean Burke for the White Sox. Thursday afternoon, getaway day for Detroit. High could be up to 70 degrees. Again, high chance of rain in Chicago. Casey Mize, who's having a great bounce back season for Detroit, will take the ball against the dart, Davis Martin. And Jim, the White Sox this season are 0-10 against the Tigers, Royals, and Guardians. They get 7 games coming up, 4 against the Tigers and 3 against the Royals. But these games are at home. Are you a little confident, optimistic, not optimistic that the White Sox can win a couple games here against the Tigers and Royals?
A couple games? I mean, it's weird.
I mean, we're talking try to go 2-5 in a 7-game
I feel like they could do that. I feel like they're pretty good. The Orioles series notwithstanding, like they're pretty good at avoiding sweep stacking up on them this year. So yeah, 2-5 sounds realistic, but it's weird to say, like, am I optimistic about them going 2-5? It feels like a sentence that swallows itself.
That's where we're at.
But yeah, let's say I'm optimistic that I'm not optimistic of them like winning more than that. But yeah, 2-5 sounds fine. They're pitching well enough, I think, to do that.
Yeah, we could see some low scoring games despite the weather. But then again, I said we're going to see some high scoring games this weekend against Baltimore and didn't see anything. So watch, these are all high scoring games. And hopefully Mother Nature is cooperative and they can get these 4 games in against Detroit. But Detroit, I think it really sneaks up on people when you look at the MLB standings, Jim. They have the Major League's best record. Are you buying the Tigers as the team to beat in the American League, or is it still the defending American League pennant winners, the New York Yankees?
I would say the Yankees, but I am confident, or more confident in, like, say, the Central, like them being the best team in the Central, separating themselves from the Guardians, just because, like, of the way the offense has come together. I think my reservations with, like, having great hopes for the Tigers was just some holes in their offense and not really having the star power to offset the holes. Like Riley Green is a nice player, but he's also somebody who is like aggressive, strikes out a lot to where, you know, he can kind of get into ruts, and can he make up for holes at like first base and the outfield and not great DH production? Like, I'm skeptical of that, but in terms of like somebody filling out a lineup, like, it's great to have Riley Green on your team. I thought they showed a lot when it came to problem solving last year with pitching. And I mean, Skubal being an unquestioned number one, you know, one of the best pitchers in the league, you know, the best pitcher in the American League last year. And then, you know, Flaherty coming back was a nice move, based on what he showed last year. You know, Mize rounding it out. Like, he's been the big, addition, or not an addition, but just returning to his form has been a huge addition for that team. And all of a sudden now you got a majority of your rotation being above average pitchers, and, you know, good for you. And then you can, like, Jackson Jobe has not been, you know, lighting the league on fire, but they can accept what he's been doing, like, as a fourth or fifth starter. Like, that's fine. So, you know, I think they're in a great position there, and they've always been good at finding relievers. So I wasn't as concerned about them on the run prevention side or the pitching side, but just, what were they going to do with their offense? I thought Gleyber Torres was like a nice pickup for them to fill out their lineup and avoid the holes. But I did not have Javier Baez coming back in center field. Did not see that coming. No. I did not see Spencer Torkelson. They looked like they were done with him. And now he looks like the number one pick he was always supposed to be. So those two players, I think, are what changes the calculus in terms of them being as good as any team in the AL Central, or as feisty to being like, oh, it's a good team, the best team in the AL Central, and can give the Yankees problems. I just, you know, want to see this mix withstand a full season. Like, you know, can Javier Baez be this player for a full season? You know, can Mize hold it together? Those are the questions I have. But in terms of what they've done with their lineup to avoid, like, just the real huge problems, like, shortstop is really the only place where you look at their production and say, like, it's, yeah, they might look for help at the deadline there.
Yeah.
Everywhere else, like, they're getting by, and that's, you know, good for them. Good for Jason Benetti, I guess, in terms of like having great games to call for a team everybody likes. Or not everybody likes their fans like it. It seems like the fans have really liked the way that the team has come together. And it must be nice.
Yeah, the Tigers' number one picks playing like number one picks. Spencer Torkelson this year leads the team with 14 homers. His OPS in the season is 856. So if you're looking for hope from Andrew Vaughn, maybe this stint down in Charlotte can spark a turnaround that it has for Torkelson. And Casey Mize this year in 9 starts, 51 innings, a 2.82 ERA. He is 6-1 on the season. Pretty impressive bounce back for Casey Mize. Yeah, Schoolbull 2.26 ERA, Flaherty 3.94, Reese Olson 2.96, Casey Mize 2.82. And to your point, Jackson Jobes got the worst ERA of the group, 4.22, and he's a rookie. So yeah, everything's really clicking for Detroit. I think I'm with you, though. Come playoff time, I would still expect the Yankees to beat the Tigers because the Yankees have Aaron Judge and the Tigers don't. And I think Aaron Judge is that big of a difference maker right now where, yes, the Tigers have a better record, but if they were to play against the Yankees in a 5-game or 7-game series in the postseason, I'm still picking the Yankees to beat the Tigers, Jim.
I think Aaron Judge, yeah, he's that good. The question I have with the Yankees is like, they have a few stories like that as well. Like Paul Goldschmidt's coming back from the dead and having some yellow flags in this game, not quite red flags, but in terms of like, I know Mike Petriello has been like a little bit skeptical in terms of like, can he keep producing like this all season? Like, aside from Judge, and you can't really say aside from Judge because he's just that massive of a presence, but like their lineup is kind of similar in terms of like a lot of good performances, no killer performances. If Judge has to miss time, like is your offense Trent Grisham based, which is weird to say. yeah, there's not that typical running mate, like, you know, with Judge and Juan Soto last year that they had, like they, you know, Jason Dominguez is doing fine, but you know, Cody Bellinger has been a nice addition, but nobody's really, there isn't a Bash brother. Yeah, it's just kind of, it's Aaron Judge and then like a great supporting staff. And so that's why I think, you know, Judge being a freak right now with just, you know, putting up Ted Williams numbers, like pre-integration basically, like in terms of, like you have to go back that far to see like a line that insane, just with the batting average involved too, that he's hard to ignore. But I do like the Tigers pitching staff better just because their bullpen seems more sound top to bottom, and I think they're getting enough from their starting pitching to where they're not going to wear their bullpen out. And so that's, I think, in low scoring games, I think the Tigers could be pretty formidable. I think the pitching staffs, like, yeah, first two starters, or like the starters are going to be looking to win postseason games, are pretty equal. Because I think, you know, Max Fried has been living up to that deal he signed. And then Carlos Rodon's been good too. But I think, like, when you look at the rest of the rotation and the bullpen, I do like the Tigers pitching staff more. It's just, yeah, they don't have that killer offensive piece right now. And it's, you know, we've saw with the 2005 White Sox. It's like that perfectly stitched together offense of players who won't kill you and players who can help you win games. You know, they can take turns getting hot. You just hope that they don't all go cool at the same time. You know, Tigers are doing a good job of sharing the load. And I think the Yankees are not too dissimilar except for one big factor.
And that could change, though. Detroit could make a big trade before the deadline to give themselves a better chance to go toe-to-toe with the Yankees and try to win the American League pennant and go back to the World Series. The Tigers have been excellent. This is not a fluke. I mean, maybe last year making the postseason and riding that hot hand that they did into the playoffs and beating the Houston Astros and really shocking the world. Maybe that was a little bit fluky and how things went down at the end of last year, but in the first 60 games, the Detroit Tigers have been excellent. This is going to be a tough series for the Chicago White Sox. Every series is tough for the White Sox, but we're hoping that the White Sox can win at least one game against the Tigers, or the next time we podcast, we're going to be talking about a 7-game losing streak for the Chicago White Sox before they play against the Kansas City Royals this upcoming weekend. And Jeff Passan at ESPN just tweeted as we are recording this that Jack Caglione, their first round pick last year, taking one spot after the White Sox selected Hagen Smith in the first round, is going to be called up to the major league. So I look forward to that reaction from White Sox fans when they see Jack Clagnone in Chicago.
I mean, that's one of my reactions that's not aging well. It's been like, I think I like the White Sox with Hagen Smith a little bit more than, because I didn't trust their hitting development. I don't know if I trust them with Jack Caglione, and then like they get Ryan Fuller afterwards. Like maybe if they put him in a different order, perhaps I would have liked Caglione a bit more. But yeah, right now with Smith on the injured list and working out some mechanical things in Birmingham and Caglione, at least earning, we'll see if he sticks. You could see the major league pitching reveal some things that just AAA pitchers aren't able to get out of him. But certainly like the way he's hitting now, certainly worth a shot. It informs what they're going to do at the deadline. They have some holes in the outfield, at first base. Just with some DH production help. So I think giving him a look now probably makes it a lot easier to understand, like, is he going to be somebody can hit in September, or we can count on in September? If not, how are we going to factor him in to what else we add come July?
The Royals desperately need offense. They have scored 7 fewer runs than the Chicago White Sox. That's how hard it's been for the Royals to score runs. They're still 2 games above 500. They're 31-29 at the 60 game mark, but they're 8 games back of Detroit, but they're only a game back of the wild cards. They think they can contend. They can compete, make the postseason this year. They're hoping that Jack Caglione helps on the offensive side. That's why they're being very aggressive right now and calling him up. And what a great way to segue into around Major League Baseball with that news of Jack Caglione being promoted. A few things that caught my eye, Jim, and I want to start with this piece from Sarah Lanes on MLB.com. She does a fantastic job when it comes to research for awesome content on Major League Baseball and MLB.com. And she wrote a piece about what it means to be in first place on June 1st. Since 1996, 60% of division winners had the lead entering June 1st. Last year, 5 of the 6 division winners had the lead on June 1st. Only Seattle didn't win their division. And when you exclude the 2020 season because they didn't play baseball in June of 2020, 16 of the last 28 World Series winners led the division on June 1st. So this is looking good, Jim, for the Yankees, Tigers, the Mariners again, the Mets, the Cubs, and the Dodgers. I want to flip the script, though. Let's say Sarah's right, and this continues at 60% of these division leaders are going to make the playoffs. Which team do you feel not confident is going to win their division despite leading on June 1st?
Well, the Mets have been running with the Phillies. I think that looks like a 2-team race right now. So I could easily see like the Phillies slipping ahead of them just because the margin isn't that high. So let's say the Mets, and also like how the Mariners haven't been able to separate themselves from the rest of the AL West when you look at some of the performances that they've had is kind of mystifying to me. Like I guess the pitching injuries are a big reason why, like not having, Logan Gilbert be at the center of everything when he was pitching so well, hurts. George Kirby missing time, that hurts. So maybe that's a simple explanation, but when you look at just how well Cal Raleigh is doing, like, man, just, yeah, it feels like a wasted opportunity. Like, when you have that kind of performance and you're still only a half game ahead of the Astros, who are figuring out themselves, like they have some gaps in their game. Like they're not getting what they thought they'd be getting out of like Yordan Alvarez. Like he's been hurt and bad and they don't have Bregman anymore. You look at the way their offense is kind of constructed and you're saying like, I guess it's like a lot of Isak Paredes, who's a good player, but it's not like the kind of, it's not like the Alex Bregman, Jose Altuve in their peak centered offenses where like, oh, these players might be going to Hall of Fame. It's a case where like, it's Isak Paredes has like a neat trick that he rides pretty well when it comes to like pulling the ball in the air to Crawford boxes. But, you know, they're somehow still hanging tough. And so, like, I do give the Astros a lot of credit for how well they're doing. Perhaps, like, when the Mariners get some separation, or they'll get some separation when they get some players back. But I also just, I don't know if I trust Jerry DePoto. So maybe I'll say, like, the Mets and the Mariners feel like the weak links here just because of their inability to separate themselves more at this point and the talent behind them.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think the Phillies are going to win the NL East, but the Mets are definitely a playoff team. I do wonder if we're getting a repeat of last year with Seattle. They're leading the division in June 1st by half a game, but I'm not exactly confident they're going to make the postseason because I could see the American League Central taking up three of the six spots again, Jim.
Yeah, I mean, like it's I guess the Twins are in the same boat in terms of like, will they be hot at the right time or cold at the wrong time? And will they tail off again like they did last year? So I think they're one team I'm skeptical about because of just how things can really turn on them. So I would maybe say the Twins open up a spot for the Mariners to fall. But yeah, otherwise, it's a case where Mariners had bad vibes, I think, when it comes to just how little they added, how upset the fans were for how little financial support went into supporting a very...
Cal Raleigh is the one that called him out as a player.
Yeah, and, you know, fans were siding with the players and thinking, like, when's the help going to come here in terms of just the supplemental big free agent additions that teams that should... Yeah, like the Mariners own the Northwest. They should be able to make that kind of splurge. Like they paid for Robinson Cano at one point.
What a move.
Yeah, I mean, like it obviously ended poorly, but he provided some production, you know, while he was there early. And like it's a case where they just need help. They can't keep getting hamstrung by either their prospects not quite getting the job done immediately or like one of like Jerry DePoto's like 5 billion transactions, not panning out. But to see the seasons Raleigh's having and then like that not being like a huge catalyst for a big lead, like we're seeing, with the Yankees, the way they're doing it, separating themselves from, what was expected to be a pretty tight division. I think it's a little bit worrisome if you're watching Seattle.
All right, so Jim and I, out of that list of six, we're not feeling confident about Seattle, and we think that the Phillies are going to beat the Mets in the National League East. But still, if four of the six do win the division, and they had the lead in June 1st, that's a remarkable fun fact that Sarah Lanes was able to find.
Yeah, I think even the Mets, like, I could see them outlasting the Phillies just because Juan Soto's been not Juan
Soto. He's heating up.
I mean, like, in terms of if he's back to being what he was at the Yankees last year, all of a sudden, like that offense is a lot more dangerous. And, you know, perhaps if they're leading and they're, do they have they have the National League's best record tied with the Cubs. Like if they're doing that without Juan Soto at his best, not nearly at his best, then perhaps, they have some upside that they can cash in on. Farm system, they have some players to trade, to make additions. So I could see them outrunning the Phillies. Just if I had to pick one, I would say maybe the Mets because the Phillies are a quality team behind them.
Got it. The Rockies, you don't have to worry about them. They're 9-50. 9-50. Wow. They're definitely going to break the White Sox record for most losses in a season. So get ready for the champagne 2024 White Sox. You can pop it pretty soon. And then finally, Shohei Ohtani, Cal Raleigh, and Aaron Judge, top three in home runs, as you mentioned with Raleigh. He's got 23 home runs this season. He's leading the majors. Ohtani's got 22. Judge has 21. Miguel Vargas leads the White Sox with 8. Vargas is on pace to hit 22 home runs right now in 2025. So, Jim, the question is, have Raleigh, Ohtani, and Judge on June 1st hit more home runs this season than anyone will for the Chicago White Sox over 162 games?
I'm going to say no, but it's close. I think Vargas could get to 25.
See, that's the number that I had in my head as well. I was going to be definitive and say, no, I believe in you, Miguel Vargas, please hit at least 23.
Yeah, the fact that he's got 8 homers, how slowly he started off and how the guaranteed right field is not played like a hitter's haven. Like there is the possibility of him having like a huge month that homers bunch up on him, and all of a sudden like the White Sox have a respectable leader. It's just a matter of like who's in second, like who's got the second most homers in the White Sox. Like that becomes like not sure about that one. Let's talk about something else. And he's on island, so. Not terrible to lead a team of 25, but if you're leading a team of 25, you'd like somebody else at 20 and have like a whole smorgasbord of 15 plus homer guys who can help hit the ball over the fence and right out of the White Sox. As long as Luis Robert is looking like he looks, and as long as Andrew Benintendi is, on and off the IL, it's like hard to find that running mate for Vargas when it comes to hitting homers.
Yeah, just thinking like if Vargas can get 25, Benintendi's second on the team with 6 home runs. Robert and Vaughn are tied with 5 home runs. Let's say we're right. And Vargas hits like another 7 home runs in the month of June. And he's at 15 entering July. I'm feeling pretty confident he could reach 25. And then we are right that no, Raleigh, Ohtani, and Judge did not hit more home runs through June 1st than the White Sox did the entire season. I don't know if anyone else is hitting 15.
Benintendi could. I guess it depends on whether he gets traded. Like if he hits well enough.
Yeah.
I still think like probably a trade is still a year away. Like it feels more like maybe next year's deadline versus this year's deadline because of the injuries, because of how much money is owed, that a team's not going to go nuts trying to trade for him. Do the financial commitment. But yeah, he's hitting the, in terms of, James wrote about it on Sunday, like in terms of, homers per plate appearances, like Benintendi is leading the team. So no reason why come July, August, Park heats up, just keeps poking balls into the Craft Cave or into the Miller Lite Landing. And you're not producing a ton around it, or not offering a whole lot of defensive value. So it feels like a pretty empty 20 homers, but it's 20 homers nevertheless.
Yeah, Benintendi still owed 2 years, $32.2 million. Over the next 2 seasons in 2026 and 2027, that doesn't include what he is going to be paid prorated wise. If you're trying to think of an Andrew Benintendi trade post July 31st, you have to add that type of money into it. Maybe a team, if Benintendi was a free agent, would be willing to pay him 2 years, $32 million, but he needs to get on a heater to make that trade possibility more realistic. But let us know what you guys think in the Sox Machine podcast comments. Have Ohtani, Raleigh, and Judge hit more home runs than anyone will for the White Sox on June 1st? Kind of a scary thought, but what a great season that Raleigh, Ohtani, and Judge have, and hopefully Vargas does reach 25 home runs to make Jim and I look a little bit smarter, and our prediction is correct. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you just discovered the Sox Machine Podcast, you can listen and subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can also listen and watch our videos on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. You can follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine. You can follow our beat reporter, James Fegan, at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. We're on Blue Sky. Simple, SoxMachine.com on Blue Sky. James is JRFegan.SoxMachine.com. I am Josh.SoxMachine.com on Blue Sky. If you enjoy our work and want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox, Major League Baseball, the MLB Draft, and even some of the college baseball happenings I'll be writing about this upcoming week as soon as the dust settles in regional play, which has been very chaotic. Jim being in Nashville, I cannot wait on Monday morning to see what that reaction is going to be with Vanderbilt being the first number one seed ever to not make the regional final. But if you want our full access and have the comment section open up for you and additional tiers of benefits as well of being a Sox Machine subscriber, go to SoxMachine.com to sign up. Monthly plans start at $5. We even have a couple spots open in our Veterans Committee as well that gets you direct access to both Jim and James in our group chat. Again, sign up at SoxMachine.com. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.